Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome to Venus Rising. I'm really excited about our guest today. Today with me is Dr. Naomi Whitaker. And Dr. Whitaker is an OBGYN physician and a fertility surgeon. So you can probably imagine why I want her on Venus Rising today. And she is focused in her practice on women's restorative reproductive medicine and compassionate healthcare and education. I wish you lived in my community because I'd have you be my doctor. She is also board certified in OBGYN and a fellowship trained surgeon who specializes in the Creighton Model Fertility Care System and NAPRO technology, which works cooperatively with a woman's body to treat the underlying cause of gynecologic issues and infertility, such as endometriosis and PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome, for those of you who don't know PCOS. Dr. Whitaker helps women improve their gynecologic health and avoid or achieve pregnancy in accordance with their natural fertility using the latest research, medicine, and surgery. Dr. Whitaker, or if I may call you Naomi, welcome to Venus Rising. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor, and I'm just so glad to be here.
Yeah, I started following you maybe a year or so ago on Instagram. So what is your Instagram handle again?
NAPRO_fertility_surgeon.
There you go. So if you guys want to follow her, and we'll be sure to put her Instagram handle in the bio when we publish the podcast. But first, I always like to ask people how you get started doing the work. Were you one of those children that grew up always wanting to be a doctor? Did you want to be a baby doctor and deliver babies?
No, actually, that was the last thing I wanted to do. I always thought of the OBGYN field as just pap smears and STDs. So I thought that didn't sound very appealing. But my parents are political refugees from Poland, and my dad especially always taught me to dream big dreams from when I was young. I grew up working with my hands with my dad doing construction, and my mom worked for the prison system more from the psychology perspective as a social worker. And so I was raised with those, with that background, and you know, in hindsight, makes sense as to how I got here with that. And I'll put that together as well. But at eight, I really was inspired to become a physician just because my mom really looked up to our physician, our family physician, and he truly treated the whole family unit. And I saw an opportunity to help people both physically and emotionally and as a whole family unit. And so I was really interested in that and really helping others in that way. And so I just always dreamed to help people in that way. And I kept looking at other things, you know, should I be a lawyer or whatever other, you know, different fields. And everything came short to the field of medicine and what I could do for others. And so I applied to medical school thinking maybe I would do family medicine or endocrinology because that was really interesting. And my husband deployed, we got married. My husband deployed to Afghanistan during that time. And that time apart, we grew a lot, and we realized, well, he realized at that point he wanted to start a family. I was shocked at this. I was not ready. I was on birth control pill. I was shutting everything down, focusing on career, trying to make it through. He's like, hey, why don't we have a family? I'm like, oh my gosh. Anyway, he won, and we ended up starting our family, and I didn't know much about women's health at all at this point. I was in my first year of medical school. You don't learn anything about women's health in that year. And here I am, the one pregnant one in the whole class, and everyone's eyes are on me, 200 other students looking at me like, what is she thinking? And everyone kind of has in the back of their mind that pressure that you can't do it. You can't do medical school and have a baby. And at least that's the mentality that I felt like I always felt pressured to feel. Anyway, so I did find an OBGYN. I didn't really know anyone, so I just picked a random one. I think like most people do, probably. And I just didn't have the most empowering experience through my pregnancy and my labor. I just didn't feel just really respected through the whole process, and nothing terrible happened by any means. It just wasn't the warm, fuzzy type of experience that I was dreaming of, kind of maybe the opposite even in some ways. And we both ended up healthy in the end. You know, I'm very grateful for that. Soon thereafter, about 2 months after I had my son and had a C-section and had just some difficulties after that, I then saw the other side as a medical student. I saw my first C-section from the other side. I couldn't believe it. I was so glad I didn't know what it was like before I had one. And so I saw the care from the other side. And I just didn't see, again, the warmth behind the care that was given. And so as I went through my rotations, I kept going back to, what am I going to do? You know, here are the pros and cons of psychiatry. Because we do different rotations, psychiatry, emergency medicine, surgery. So as I went through each rotation, you know, I try to keep an open mind. Do I want to do this? And every time I would eventually go back to OBGYN because a lot of other fields of medicine, such as, okay, you have pneumonia. This is the antibiotic therapy you need. And it's pretty clear cut. But with OBGYN, there is a lot of gray. You know, when do you decide to do the C-section? How do you approach the woman about the C-section while you're doing it? You know, how do you make the C-section experience for that woman? For example, it makes a huge difference for that person. Or how do you approach miscarriage? I saw as a trainee, as a medical student, I saw the resident talk to a patient. She diagnosed her with her third miscarriage on ultrasound. And the patient wasn't very compliant, so she wasn't really taking blood pressure medications like she should. And so the resident walked out of the room and said, well, she was only 10 weeks, you know, why was she crying? And that really hit me hard, seeing, again, the lack of compassion. And I think part of that was a mechanism of trying to handle difficult situations, because it is hard to see miscarriages often, which we do see often. That's why they come see us. And so some of it is a coping mechanism, but it was really hard for me to see. And again, solidified, okay, we can do better for women's health. And as much as I try to fight it, because the work hours are challenging, the family life balance is not easy, I just felt called to be in this field. Plus, I like working with my hands, and the whole family component came together, and endocrine, it all came together. And my passion for just I can't get enough reading, the reading material or podcasts like yours. Just, I love.
Great. So it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when we look at infertility, it's usually divvied up to 1/3 of infertility is caused by there's something wrong with the female body, 1/3 is perhaps the male component, and 1/3 is the kind of catch-all. We can't figure out why this couple can't conceive. We've done every test, we've looked at everything. Is that an accurate in your assessment breakdown?
I think it depends on who you go to for your treatment. So I'd say overall, if you head to most regular, you know, general OBGYNs, and then end up in an REI clinic, a reproductive endocrinology clinic, who focus on IVF as a treatment. Yes, that is a good overview of generally what is found. 30% of infertility is unexplained, is what they say.
Yeah.
And the ACOG literature says 40 to 50% has at least a component of male factor. But in reality, it's much more complicated than that. I don't believe in unexplained infertility. I do believe there's always an explanation. Yeah, but yeah, it's usually multifactorial.
So since this Venus Rising, where we talk about all things related to female fertility and infertility, what are some of the more common factors that a woman is going to be faced with or diagnosed with if, you know, she's been trying, you know, for 12 months, unprotected sex, regular intercourse, can't conceive? What are you going to be working her up for and ruling out?
Sure. So first, I do recommend a woman empowers herself with learning how to chart her cycles. So what I recommend is the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. And so a woman is taught a standardized way to observe her own cycle. And so she meets one-on-one with a fertility care teacher, and learns how to objectively and prospectively chart observations of her cycles on a chart. And so that's the first place to start. And so just that helps women know when they're fertile, because sometimes that's the problem. People just don't know when they're fertile and infertile.
And then once they know when they're fertile and then they have intercourse and then they don't conceive, what comes next?
This is my secret tool is this chart. And so it gives me a lot of information. And so that practitioner who teaches them how to chart will next look at other biomarkers and teach the woman, make sure that she's charting correctly. So one big thing is the cervical mucus, seeing quantity, when it's occurring, if they're using those days of fertility. Other biomarkers on the chart would include abnormal bleeding, such as tail end brown bleeding at the end of their period of 2 days or more is a sign that something could be not right. Too many days of bleeding, premenstrual bleeding, PMS symptoms, especially greater than 3 days prior to the onset of the period, irregular luteal phases, so variable luteal phases. So a luteal phase is the time between ovulation and the next period. And so if that changes a lot, that could be a sign of a luteal phase defect. Or if it's short, it could be a sign of a luteal phase defect. So any of those can lead to PMS, can lead to miscarriage, and can be a sign of unhealthy ovulation or not ovulating.
And how much does polycystic ovarian syndrome affect a woman's fertility? Because that's a pretty common syndrome, correct? PCOS is not uncommon.
Correct. It's very common. It's one of the most common causes of infertility, probably the most common endocrine cause of infertility. And the main reason women with PCOS have infertility is they aren't ovulating as frequently. So some of them may only ovulate 3 times a year. So they may otherwise be completely fine, their tubes open and everything. But if they are only fertile so the egg lasts 12 to 24 hours, and the fertile window can be pushed to 4 to 5 days with good quality mucus. So that's 15 days maybe of the whole year max that woman is fertile. To actually pinpoint those days and use those days alone without, and that's saying everything else is perfect, that's going to be difficult to do, especially if a woman doesn't know when that happens.
And within your practice, the Creighton model and NAPRO technology, do you ever use fertility drugs? Do you ever use any kind of surgical interventions? Anything that you can do restorative, palliative, inside the body?
Yes. So the Creighton chart is a huge first step to kind of start to work up, get a lot of labs, cycle day 3 to see if the signals to their ovaries is healthy. We do ultrasounds to see if they're ovulating. Do an ultrasound to see if they have anything obviously abnormal, such as fibroids or big balls of endometriosis in their ovaries called endometriomas. And we also can get labs based on their ovulation. So we put those pieces together, the chart, the Creighton model chart, and their symptoms. And then we talk about, how to correct her specific issues. And so we really do a full workup of what's going on, check the thyroid, vitamin D, things like that. So yes, based on that, we do check fallopian tubes with something called a selective hysterosalpingogram. So that is similar to a regular hysterosalpingogram, which checks the fallopian tubes. But it's much more accurate because we can measure the pressure. If there's any resistance, we'll know. So I don't want it just to be open. I want it to be perfect. I don't want there to be even a somewhat of slow fill, partial fill. Your eyes can't really tell sometimes that there is some issue with the tubes. So objectively measuring that with a guide wire that measures the pressure, it tells me if there's any issue and I'm able to open them up. So I check the tubes, if that's indicated, looking inside the uterus and in the abdomen for issues, again, if that's indicated based on their history and really seeing, if they have any physical barriers to conceiving. I find cervical stenosis, so the sperm can't even get in through the cervix, or fibroids obstructing the cavity, or the tubes are blocked, or endometriosis is a big one. And yes, even PCOS has some surgical options as a treatment, especially if it's a severe case and have failed medical management. As far as medical management, we do offer that as well. So instead of overriding the natural cycle, we know exactly what's going on with the cycle by knowing prospectively every cycle exactly when someone's ovulating. So we're able to work cooperatively with the cycle and use very low dose medications to boost ovulation if they have an ovulation disorder, and then help support that luteal phase defect with, again, a little boost. So typically, the standard medicine, they're flying blind and they don't know when ovulation happens. And that's the biggest, one of the biggest things we need to know when treating someone. And so they give higher dose ovulation medications, more often a trigger, potentially IUI, to kind of artificially control the cycle. Sometimes they're even put on birth control for a few months while they're trying to get pregnant to kind of override the cycle so that they can time everything. And so it's very different when you know, when you can see what the body's trying to do and you understand what the body's strengths are to help boost the strengths, know what needs to be fixed and what doesn't. And yeah, treating the underlying cause, the issues such as endometriosis, PCOS, you know, fibroids, ovulation disorders, treating those underlying issues can get women pregnant in a natural way and help them have a healthy pregnancy. And if not, at least emotionally, it's really healing for them to know, oh my gosh, this is what caused it. It wasn't me. It wasn't my fault. Because so many of these women come to me with unexplained infertility, they blame themselves. And so what I often hear when I take women to surgery is, I hope you find something. My worst fear is you're not going to find anything. Which is weird. Like they're so excited. Usually for a lot of women are excited about surgery. They want to know what's going on. And that's their worst fear. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, that really is saying something as they're about to go to sleep for surgery. But that's how much it means to them just to have an answer.
It must be a woman thing, because I even see that in the work I do working with surrogates when they're getting ready to do another surrogacy or, you know, getting ready for the embryo transfer. They have a failed embryo transfer. Even they feel guilty. Because they feel like, oh, this couple is depending on me to give them that gift that they haven't been able to get on their own. And they've already had so many years of heartache or, you know, lost pregnancy, whatever. So it's interesting that people just want to know, it's nothing I did wrong. It's not that right. I did something wrong, but I know now what's causing it. So that's interesting. Well, I'm just listening to you and thinking, because, you know, my most recent film's Big Fertility. I did take a big old whack at the industry, the fertility industry. You know, I listened to you speak and I think, why aren't all women demanding or asking for this type of less is better, more holistic, more women-centered, let's figure out what's wrong? And I'm sure I'm biased, but I see, you know, let's just shove the woman off to the reproductive endocrinologist, let's just put her on the IVF superhighway. And why aren't your other colleagues in your field of medicine all jumping on this way of treating female fertility issues?
Sure. I'll start with the patients. That's a little...
Sure. Start with the patients. Okay. Why aren't the patients demanding it?
Well, first of all, because we've been in this since the 70s. And so that's always, people think that's the only way to do it anymore, unfortunately. So I had a patient recently. I counseled about her IVF success percentages based on her age, which is really low, over 42, for example, or over 40. And then she came back to me and was like, you weren't doing anything. You know, I'm like, well, you're doing it. Like, your cycle of trying your around your ovulation, that's my version of IUI. And it was so hard for her to understand that. Like, timed intercourse with assistance, with my assistance, is similar to an IUI. And
IUI, explain to our listeners.
For example, okay, intrauterine insemination. So she just didn't feel like we were doing enough because me as the physician, I'm not injecting, you know, semen into her uterus, you know? And so it didn't feel like she was doing as much, even though she was, if that makes any sense. So we as a society, I feel like she illustrated, like, we as a society have made our bodies into like a machine where there's an on and off switch. We feel like we can be on birth control for 10, 15, 20 years. And now, okay, I'm 35. I want to get pregnant. Here's the on switch. Again, the doctor needs to do this thing for me instead of really understanding what's going on and working cooperatively with the cycle. So I think, number one, it's hard for people after having IVF around for so long And then women being on the pill, so that aids women in not really understanding what's going on with their bodies. And so us as physicians, we stopped pregnancy. Now it's our turn, I guess, if it doesn't happen, to override it and make it happen. So I think there's some kind of, you know, something to that, I guess. But as far as physicians, that's how we're trained. So we could get into the whole history of how we got to where we are in medicine. But in the 70s, we thought, 70s to 80s, we thought IVF was the next big breakthrough. We won't need all the other invasive things we had before, like surgery or, yeah, the other really time-consuming workup. We have IVF now. And with time, we're seeing that the success rate isn't as good as we had hoped. And in fact, it hasn't really gotten better since then. So in our medical training, once we do something new for 10 to 20 years, it's hard to go back and relearn all the art that has been lost. So there are some reproductive endocrinologists that really do a good job looking up the underlying issue, you know, not being afraid to do surgery and complex surgery or send to a surgeon that's good at that. But reproductive endocrinology training has really focused on IVF. They spend more time doing IVF than surgery, for example. And surgery, to do a good job, you have to really be in the operating room for a long time, be exposed to a lot of complicated cases. So I think it's a lost art. And so the lost art has affected the culture and our thinking.
And we're impatient. Yeah.
We're impatient.
We want quick fixes. You know,
yeah.
And I, you know, I am cynical, but I just think it's a very, very lucrative field of medicine too.
It is.
And because there are so many failed cycles and you have repeat business and repeat business. And so I think that's problematic. And, you know, I always say it's just amazing that human beings can reproduce, because like you say, with all the things that can just be wrong with our bodies, you know, the fact that you know, the example you use of the woman with that PCOS, she may only have a few days in a whole entire year when she could actually conceive. I just think we're so impatient, you know, when things don't happen right away, you know, we get off our birth control and we expect the next month we're going to be pregnant because I'm ready to have that baby now. What do you think, because I'm in the backyard of the Silicon Valley here, what do you think of the new employee benefit that all the high-tech companies are giving to women to freeze and bank their own eggs for their later, this whole fertility preservation, is that another pie in the sky thing? We can, again, have our children when we're ready for them, and now we can bank and freeze our eggs and go get them later when we're finally ready.
I think it's part of the big lie to women that I was told even, and that I believed for many years, you know, just wait, put your career first, do what the Hollywood stars do and have babies in your 40s and 50s maybe, and it looks like no big deal. So let's do something that was recently just experimental, the egg freezing. And, you know, there are risks with that, and the success rate isn't really that good. Also, then you're forced later to do IVF. Potentially, if you wait, if you truly believe that that's going to work for you and you wait till you're 45, then at that point, you're forced to do IVF, right? And so, and then you're a high-risk pregnancy at that point, very high-risk if you're able to get pregnant at that point. So I think it's misleading to women.
Because of the age of the woman, is that why?
So age, also IVF itself, increases the risk of all pregnancy complications. And so for sure, if someone gets pregnant with IVF at 45, I mean, it would be a miracle if they didn't have major complications in my eyes. I would be very worried about them.
Do you ever have patients that you're not able to help that are really wanting to have a child? They leave because they want to go do IVF, or they want to go buy eggs from an egg donor or use a surrogate womb. Have you had those kind of patients that just say, I'm going to go to somebody who can help me get that baby?
Yeah, I've had that. So one time I had one in the last year, but she ended up getting pregnant while she was waiting to get on their list. So again, feeling like nothing was happening, but they were actually, you know, using fertile days after surgery and things that help them heal. So, but yeah, sometimes absolutely. I mean, that is, you know, and I'll support a woman and take care of her in her pregnancy for whatever route she chooses. Absolutely. And there's no judgment there. I just like to counsel them about the risks and the low success rate that occurs with IVF. Just be real with them. Because when and I don't know every IVF clinic and how they are, but when I shadowed as a part of my training, an IVF physician, the counseling was not very thorough at all. And the treatment plan was based on their ability to pay, either with insurance or how much money they had. And so it was more of a scare tactic that I saw. Oh, you're 35, look at your eggs dying, and you need IVF. It was obviously, I mean, it seemed quite biased based on trying to get that cash, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think it's really unfortunate that when you look at the IVF model, the big fertility model, it really is a model only available to the affluent or the well-insured. You know, if you're a low-income woman, if you're a woman who doesn't have any kind of insurance and you're infertile, you know, there's not reproductive endocrinologists and IVF doctors out there just lining up to help you to conceive. It's a more of a boutique concierge kind of a model of medicine, which is unfortunate. You know, well, if we have young girls listening, what would you tell them now, you know, before they're, I mean, like teenagers, young girls? I'm always impressed because I show exploitation. I meet with a lot of college age girls. I'm always amazed with how ignorant in the age of information and how much the internet is, you know, there available to learn anything, how much women still know very little about their own bodies and their own reproductive bodies. What would you tell young women that they should be doing now to be mindful of, you know, preserving their fertility if they want to have children?
Sure. So I think empowering yourself with education about your own menstrual cycle, I think the best way is with the Creighton model system. Personally, that's where I'm trained. And so I just use that as an example, but there's a lot coming out now with the technology coming out, but you have to be careful not to use certain systems because if they're based on the calendar method, for example, it's not very accurate. So for example, with the Creighton model, it's a reliable way to be able to monitor your gynecologic health, see if you're ovulating, see if your PMS, if you have PMS that's abnormal, especially, I think most PMS is abnormal. Painful cycles, being proactive with treatment of your gynecologic health, not ignoring problems, not saying, well, my friend's periods are worse than mine, so I must be okay, or everyone tells me this is normal. Find someone who listens to you and will help you be proactive. So when I help treat young women with severe debilitating periods when they're young, I do think it helps them long-term with their fertility. So if I find early endometriosis, I think it's very empowering to them. First, their pain is legitimized. Like you're not crazy. You have something wrong. Then I'm able to treat it and remove the endometriosis. Then their periods are a lot more tolerable. I can help them see if they haven't suggest an ovulation issue, and I'm able to counsel them. Look, I think you're good. You're good to go. We caught it early. You hopefully won't have to worry about this for a long time or ever. Hopefully. But I've had other young women where I've operated on, and the endometriosis is extremely, extremely severe. And then, of course, I counsel. You don't know how that's going to impact fertility, but you're at high risk that this could cause an issue. So if you're serious about having a family, you know, I mean, I don't think you should rush out and have kids. But if you find that person, you might want to be more proactive than wait, you know, the 10 years, because you're going to have likely a more difficult time. And so, you know, these women are really grateful to know that young, and yeah, use that information.
And it's sad that that's just not a given, that they're, you know, that we're educating young women. You know, every young woman, I remember my mother, I had all sisters, you know, the first time we had our period, that's when we went off to the lady doctor, you know, had our first introduction to the OBGYN office, you know, but those are things I was never told, you know, mm-hmm. Getting a pelvic exam. Nobody ever asked me anything about anything, just, you know, just going through the regular physical exam. What are your thoughts on the whole third party conception, the space that I work heavily in? I mean, does that kind of break your heart when you see, you know, young women on college campuses being sort of recruited and targeted for selling their eggs, and, you know, young moms in America being recruited and you know, marketed and targeted for their uteruses?
Yeah, I think we have to ask, you know, who are we targeting, and, you know, is that ethical? It being marketing to vulnerable populations, I think, shows in of itself that there's an issue. Would affluent women who have other choices volunteer to do this?
Yeah.
You know, those are questions to ask.
And you mentioned that, you know, the IVF adds complication and risk to pregnancy of the woman who's doing IVF for herself. And of course, that transfers that risk to the surrogate mother who has her own children at home and who's taking these risks. Explain to our listeners, what are those additional risks that IVF adds to, you know, complicate pregnancy?
Sure. So every single complication of pregnancy is increased through IVF. So whether a woman uses her own eggs and her husband's sperm, it's probably the lowest in that case, but still all risks are increased, including preterm birth. Probably one of the highest risks is preeclampsia, where a woman develops high blood pressure in pregnancy and can cause a preterm birth, can cause, you know, stroke, for example, if severe preterm labor. I think I might have said that one. Gestational diabetes, abnormal placentation, where the placenta grows like over the cervix, or it can cause like hemorrhage in pregnancy, for example. Also, birth defects are increased. Now, we think this may be related to, so preeclampsia is related to potentially an autoimmune component where the body fights against the pregnancy. And we see this in extremes of age of women, really young and really old in IVF, but even more so in someone who's a surrogate and they have foreign DNA in their body. So preeclampsia risk is lowered, well, is actually increased in women who have used condoms or have a new birth partner. So potentially a woman is desensitized to semen over, so there's some natural things we don't quite understand, but there is data to suggest that being desensitized to, let's say, your partner's semen over time will likely reduce the risk of preeclampsia. Now, take that in the extreme opposite, where a foreign man's semen and or sperm and a foreign woman's egg is put together and implanted in your body. Now, that risk of preeclampsia shoots up significantly, gestational diabetes, preterm labor.
And is it compounded because, you know, surrogates do it again and again? Surrogates will do several cycles of embryo transfer that doesn't actually end up in a pregnancy till she's finally pregnant and conceived. Does that risk kind of compound with that exposure to that autoimmune, or is that not
I would love to see data on that, but that's not looked into.
That was my next question. We'll get to that.
Where is the research?
Yeah.
Why are we not informing these women of the risk? We don't know. But theoretically, yes, as someone, you know, autoimmune conditions get worse with exposures and with age. And so I would think potentially it would increase. Yeah. But I would love to see the research on long-term implications of IVF on women or surrogates, both. But
and
it's
egg
just
donors.
Not done.
I mean, there's no risk on egg donors. And what does this long-term do to their ability to conceive, or to their longer-term, perhaps, cancer incidence increase from, you know, I've met women who've sold their eggs 10 times. And we know that an egg donor gets much higher doses of fertility drugs than maybe the infertile patient. You know, they get the kid glove, less is better approach versus the egg donor who's being paid to produce 20, 30, 40 eggs in a cycle. You know, they don't want just one egg from her. So she's going to be on pretty big gun levels. I spoke to a surrogate once who she was doing, I think, her second or third surrogacy, and she was having a lot of complications, and she kept asking why she was on such high doses of fertility drugs, because her previous surrogacy she was on about half the dose, and they basically said, this is our clinic, this is our protocol, this is what we do.
Yes.
And they wouldn't change, they wouldn't adjust, even though she was having symptoms from this high level of drugs. So quite a racket. All right, we're about out of time, but I was going to ask you, just because there's mostly women who listen to this, but a lot of times women have husbands or partners. What can Crichton NAPRO technology, and I know you're an OBGYN, so you don't see the men, correct? What can you guys offer when it's a male infertility problem?
Sure. So we do analyze the seminal fluid parameters. And so we can see if there's, you know, low motility, low volume, evidence of white blood cells. And so depending on what's wrong, potentially just doing some supplements or lisinopril, low dose lisinopril can help all parameters. That's a blood pressure medication. Men can get Clomid, HCG, different medical treatments versus getting a workup with a urologist, seeing if they have something called the varicocele. But yeah, even many simple supplements such as Fertilade is a common one that I recommend with high doses of vitamin E and CoQ10, things like that can really help with the sperm count. And so optimizing that, in addition to optimizing the woman, is going to maximize the chances.
Yeah. And is what would you say is when you have a male infertility problem or you have a female infertility problem, would you be able to say you're more successful in helping either one of them? Or is it just really depending on what the issue is?
It's more of what the issue is and the severity. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. What's a good success story? I'm sure you have many in your practice. You know,
yeah.
I'm sort of putting you on the spot with that one, but sure. I'm sure you can think of like the couple that they felt like you were their last hope. They tried everything, you know, many miscarriages.
Oh gosh. Yeah. There are quite a few, but the one, her body was trying to go through menopause. Her body was acting a little older than her actual age. And she had had one miracle baby actually earlier with our system, and it wasn't that hard last time, but time had moved on and her ovaries were trying to just totally give out now. And so we were able to reverse her ovarian aging, optimize her fallopian tubes, remove a giant fibroid. She had a very, very, very difficult ovulation disorder, one of the most difficult to treat, did some ovulation medications and triggers. She had gotten a puppy with the stimulus stuff from COVID, because she was going to be done. She was going to be just give up because it was a lot. She had been doing this for a while for this last one and it wasn't looking very good. So she got a golden retriever puppy and had a little bit of medication left. So she's going to do one last cycle and she got pregnant on that cycle.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Must be fun being in the delivery room when those babies are born. I mean, it's fun when any baby is born.
But those are extra special.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, like I said, our time has come to an end, but you know, we'll have to have you on again because I've already thought about, we didn't talk about artificial wombs and uterine transplants and synthetic eggs, all the stuff that's coming down the pike. So anyway, thank you so much for being with us today on Venus Rising, and we'll put your Instagram handle and, you know, send us any other way that people can reach you. You practice in the state of Pennsylvania, so people can find you there if they're looking for Dr. Whitaker's professional care. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.